Book 2. Eaters of Diamonds and Gems. I heard a story of a river, which is where water flows over the ground, glistening in the sun. It's a legend, and untrue. In the story, the water is clear, and that's why it's untrue. We all know water is the color of blood. People make up legends to teach lessons, so I think the story is about us, about a river of blood. And one day, we'll run clear. Of a River, Badal. Chapter 7. The horrid creatures jostle in their line, a row of shields and a row of painted faces. They marched out of my mouth, as slayers are wont to do, when no one was looking busy, as they were, with their precious banners and standards, and with the music of stepping in time, as the righteous are wont to do. Now see all these shiny weapons so eager to clash in the discord of stunned agreement, blind as millipedes in the mud, as between lovers words may do. In the murky depths, swans slip like seals, scaling the ice walls of cold's prison. All we dream is without tether. Confessions of the Condemned, Banathos of Blue Rose. The errant walked the flooded tunnel, remembering the bodies that had once drifted there, shifting like logs, flesh turning to jelly. Now, on occasion, in pushing a foot forward, he kicked aside unseen bones. Darkness promised no solitude, no true abandonment, no final resting place. Darkness was nothing more than a home for the forgotten. Which was why sarcophagi had lids and crypts were sealed under stone and barrows beneath heaped earth. Darkness was the vision behind shuttered eyes, little more than the dismissal of light when details ceased to be relevant. He could find such a world. All he needed to do was close his one remaining eye. It should work. He did not understand why it didn't. The water, bitter cold, lapped around his thighs. He welcomed its gift of numbness. The air was foul, but he was used to that. There should be nothing to hold him here, chaining him to this moment. Events were unfolding, so many events, and not all of them shifting to his touch, twisting to his will. Anger was giving way to fear. He had sought out the altar Featherwitch had consecrated in his name. He had expected to find her soul, her fleshless will curling in sinew currents round the submerged rubble. But there had been nothing, no one. Where had she gone? He could still feel her hair beneath his hand, the muted struggles as some remnant of her sanity groped for air, for one more moment of life. His palm tingled with the echo of her faint convulsions beginning in that moment when she surrendered and filled her lungs with water, once, twice, like a newborn trying out the gifts of an unknown world, only to retreat, fade away, and slide like an eel back into the darkness, where the first thing forgotten was oneself. This should not be haunting him. His act had been one of mercy. Gangrenous, insane, she'd had little time left. It had been the gentlest of nudges, not at all motivated by vengeance or disgust. Still, she might well have cursed him in that last exhaled, soured breath. Her soul should be swimming these black waters, but the errant knew that he had been alone. The altar chamber had offered him little more than desolation. Wading, the tunnel's slimy floor descending with each step, his feet suddenly lost all grip and the water rose yet higher, past his chest, closing over his shoulders and lapping at his throat. The top of his head brushed the gritty stone of the tunnel's ceiling, and then he was under, blinking the sting from his eye. He pushed onward through the murk, until the water turned salty, and light, reflecting down from a vague surface fathoms overhead, flashed like dulled, smeared memories of lightning. He could feel the heavy tugs of wayward currents, and he knew that a storm did indeed rage, there upon the ceiling of this world. But it could do little to him down here. Scraping through thick mud, he walked the ocean floor. Nothing decayed in this place. and all that had not been crushed to dust by the immense pressures now lay scattered beneath monochrome draperies of silt, like furniture in a vast abandoned room. Everything about this realm invited horror. Time lost its way here, wandering until the ceaseless rain of detritus weighed it down, brought it to its knees, and then buried it. Anything, anyone, could fall to the same fate. The danger, the risk, was very real. No creature of sentience could withstand this place for long. Futility delivered its crushing symphony, and the dread music was eternal. He found himself walking down the length of a vast skeleton, jagged, uneven ribs rising like the columns of a colonnade to either side, a roofless temple sagging under its own senseless burden. He passed the snaking line of boulders that was the immense creature's spine. Four scapulae formed broad concave platforms just ahead, from which bizarre long bones radiated out like toppled pillars. He could just make out, in the gloom, the massive crown of the back of the monster's skull. Here, then, awaited another kind of temple, precious store of self, a space insisting on its occupation, an existence that demanded acknowledgement of its own presence. The errant sympathized with the notion. Such delicate conceits assembled the bones of the soul, after all. He moved past the last of the scapulae, noting the effect of some crushing, no doubt crippling, impact. The bone looked like a giant broken plate. Coming alongside the skull, he saw that the cave of its nearest orbital socket was shattered. Above and behind, an elongated, partly collapsed snout, crowded with serrated teeth. The elder god paused and studied that damage for some time. He could not imagine what this beast had been. He suspected it was a child of these deep currents, a swimmer through ancient ages, entirely uncomprehending that its time was past. He wondered if mercy had delivered that death blow. Ah, but he could not fight his own nature, could he? Most of his nudges were fatal ones, after all. The impetus might find many justifications, and clearly mercy numbered among them. This was, he told himself, a momentary obsession. The feel of her hair under his hand. A lapse of conscience, then, this tremor of remorse. It would pass. He pushed on, knowing that at last he'd found the right trail. There were places that could only be found by invitation, by the fickle generosity of the forces that gave them shape, that made them what they were. Such barriers defied the hungers and needs of most seekers. But he had learned the secret paths long, long ago. He required no invitations, and no force could stand in the way of his hunger. The dull gleam of the light in the tower reached him before he could make out anything else, and he flinched at seeing that single mocking eye floating in the gloom. Currents swept fiercely around him as he drew closer, buffeting his body as if desperate to turn him aside. Silt swirled up, seeking to blind him. But he fixed his gaze on that fitful glow, and before long he could make out the squat, blockish house, the black, gnarled branches of the trees in the yard, and then the low stone wall. Dunes of silt were heaped up against the tower side of the Azath. The mounds in the yard were sculpted, half-devoured, exposing the roots of the leaning trees. As the errant stepped onto the snaking flagstones of the path, he could see bones scattered out from those sundered barrows. Yes, they had escaped their prisons at long last, but death had arrived first. Patience was the curse of longevity. It could lure its ageless victim into somnolence until flesh itself rotted off and the skull rolled free. He reached the door, pushed it open. The currents within the narrow entranceway swept over him warm as tears. As the portal closed behind him, the errant gestured. A moment later, he was standing on dry stone. Hovering faint on the air around him was the smell of wood smoke. A wavering globe of lantern light approached from the corridor beyond. The threadbare figure that stepped into view sent a pang through the errant. Memories murky as the sea bottom spun up to momentarily blind him. The gaunt Forkrel Asael was hunched at the shoulders, as if every proof of justice had bowed him down, left him broken. His pallid face was a mass of wrinkles like crushed leather. Tortured eyes fixed on the errant for a moment, and then the Asael turned away.
Fire and wine await us, Erastus. Come, you know the way.
They walked through the double doors at the conjunction of the corridors into the dry heat of the hearth room. The Asael gestured at a sideboard as he hobbled to one of the chairs flanking the fireplace. Ignoring the invitation to drink, for the moment, the errant walked to the other chair and settled into it. They sat facing one another.
"You have suffered some," said the Asael, "since I last saw you, Erastus."
"Laughter from the abyss, Setch. Have you seen yourself lately?"
"The forgotten must never complain."
He'd found a crystal goblet, and he now held it up and studied the flickering flames trapped in the amber wine.
"When I look at myself, I see embers. They dim, they die. It is," he added, "well."
And he drank. The errant bared his teeth.
"Pathetic. Your hiding is at an end, Knuckles."
Sir Chulath smiled at the old title, but it was a bitter smile.
"Our time is past."
"It was, yes, but now it shall be reborn." Sir Chul shook his head.
"You were right to surrender the first time."
"That was no surrender. I was driven out."
"You were forced to relinquish all that you no longer deserved."
The haunted eyes lifted to trap the errant's glare.
"Why the resentment?"
"We were allies."
"So we were."
"We shall be again, Knuckles. You were the Elder God who stood closest to my throne."
"Your empty throne, yes."
"A battle is coming. Listen to me. We can cast aside all these pathetic new gods. We can drown them in blood."
The errant leaned forward.
"Do you fear that it will be you and me alone against them? I assure you, old friend, we shall not be alone."
He settled back once more, stared into the fire.
"Your mortal kin have found new power, made new alliances."
Knuckles snorted.
"You would trust to the peace and justice of the Forkrel Asael after all they once did to you?"
"I trust the necessity they have recognized."
"Erastus, my time is at an end."
He made a rippling gesture with his fingers.
"I leave it to the twins."
He smiled.
"They were my finest cast."
"I refuse to accept that. You will not stand aside in what is to come. I have forgotten nothing. Remember the power we once wielded?"
"I remember. Why do you think I'm here?"
"I want that power again. I will have it."
"Why?"
Knuckles asked softly.
"What is it you seek?"
"Everything that I have lost."
"Ah, old friend, then you do not remember everything."
"No."
"No. You have forgotten why you lost it in the first place."
A long moment of silence. The errant rose and went over to pour himself a goblet of wine. He returned and stood looking down upon his fellow elder god.
"I am not here," he said, "for you alone."
Knuckles winced.
"I intend as well to summon the clan of elders, all who have survived. I am master of the tiles. They cannot deny me."
"No," Knuckles muttered. "That we cannot do."
"Where is she?"
"Sleeping."
The errant grimaced.
"I already knew that, Setch."
"Sit down, Erastus. For now, please. Let us just sit here. Let us drink in remembrance of friendship and innocence."
"When our goblets are empty, Knuckles."
He closed his eyes and nodded.
"So be it."
"It pains me to see you so,"
the errant said as he sat back down.
"We shall return you to what you once were."
"Dear Erastus, have you not learned? Time cares nothing for our wants, and no god that has ever existed can be as cruel as time."
The errant half closed his remaining eye.
"Wait until you see the world I shall make, Setch. Once more you shall stand beside the empty throne. Once more you shall know the pleasure of mischance, striking down hopeful mortals one by one.
I do remember, Knuckles murmured, how they railed at misfortune.
And sought to appease ill fate with ever more blood, upon the altars, upon the fields of battle,
and in the dark bargains of the soul.
The errant nodded, pleased, relieved. Yes, he could wait for this time, this brief healing span. It served and served well. He could grant her a few more moments of rest.
So tell me, ventured Knuckles, the tale.
What tale?
The one that took your eye.
The errant scowled and looked away, his good mood evaporating.
Mortals, he said, will eat anything.
In the tower of the Azath, within a chamber that was an entire realm, she slept and she dreamed. And since dreams existed outside of time, she was walking anew a landscape that had been dead for millennia. But the air was sharp still, the sky overhead as pure in its quicksilver brilliance as the day of its violent birth. On all sides, buildings, reduced to rubble, formed steep-sided, jagged mounds. Passing floods had caked mud on everything to a height level with her hips. She walked, curious, half-disbelieving. Was this all that remained? It was hard to believe. The mounds looked strangely orderly, the chunks of stone almost uniform in size. No detritus had drifted down into the streets or lanes. Even the flood silts had settled smooth on every surface.
Nostalgia!
A voice called down. She halted, looked up to see a white-skinned figure perched atop one of the mounds, gold hair hanging long, loose, hinting of deep shades of crimson. A white-bladed two-handed sword leaned against one side of his chest, the multifaceted crystal pommel flashing in the brightness. He took many forms, this creature, some pleasant, others, like this one, like a spit of acid in her eyes.
This is your work, isn't it?
One of his hands stroked the sword's enamel blade, the sensuality of the gesture making her shiver. He said,
I deplore your messiness, Kilmandaros.
While you make death seem so tidy,
he shrugged.
Tell me, if on your very last day, day or night, it makes no difference, you find yourself in a room, on a bed even, too weak to move, but able to look around, that's all. Tell me, Kilmandaros, will you not be comforted by the orderliness of all that you see? By the knowledge that it will persist beyond you, unchanged, bound to its own slow, so slow measure of decay?
You ask if I will be what, Oserk? Nostalgic about a room I'm still in?
Is that not the final gift of dying?
She held up her hands and showed him her fists.
Come down here and receive just such a gift, Oserk. I know this body, this face that you show me now. I know the seducer and know him too well. Come down. Do you not miss my embrace?
And in the dread truths of dreams, Oserk then chuckled, the kind of laugh that cut into its victim, that shot tight the throat, dismissive, devoid of empathy, a laugh that said, you no longer matter to me. I see your hurt and it amuses me. I see how you cannot let go of the very thing I have so easily flung away, the conceit that we still matter to each other. So much, yes, in a dream's laugh.
Emorlan is in pieces, he said, and most of them are now as dead as this one. Would you blame me, Anomander Scabandari?
I'm not interested in your stupid finger-pointing. The one who accuses has nothing to lose and everything to hide.
Yet you joined with Anomander.
He too was not interested in blame. We joined together, yes, to save what we could.
Too bad, then, Oserk said, that I got here first.
Where have the people gone, Osirk, now that you've destroyed their city?
His brows lifted.
Why, nowhere.
He gestured, a broad sweep of one hand, encompassing the rows of mounds around them.
I denied them their moment of nostalgia.
She found herself trembling.
Come down here, she said in a rasp. Your death is long overdue.
Others concur, he admitted. In fact, it's why I'm lingering here. Only one portal survives. No, not the one you came through. That one has since crumbled.
And who waits for you there, Osirk?
Edgewalker.
Kilmandaros bared her massive fangs in a broad smile, and then threw a laugh back at him. She moved on. His voice sounded surprised as he called out behind her.
What are you doing? He is angry. Do you not understand? He is angry.
And this is my dream, she whispered, where all that has been is yet to be.
And still she wondered. She had no recollection, after all, of this particular place, nor of meeting Osirk among the shattered remnants of Khorald Emelan. Sometimes, it is true, she told herself, that dreams prove troubling.
Clouds on the horizon, black, advancing in broken lines.
Stormy knuckled his eyes and then glared across at Gessler from a momentarily reddened face.
What kind of stupid dream is that?
How should I know? There are cheats who make fortunes interpreting the dreams of fools. Why not try one of those?
You calling me a fool?
Only if you follow my advice, Stormy.
Anyway, that's why I howled.
Gessler leaned forward, clearing tankards and whatnot to make room for his thick, scarred forearms.
Falling asleep in the middle of a drinking session is unforgivable enough. Waking up screaming, why, that's just obnoxious. Had half the idiots in here clutching at their chests.
We shouldn't have skipped out on the war game, Guess.
Not again. It wasn't like that. We volunteered to go and find Helion.
He nodded to the third occupant of the table, although only the top of her head was visible, the hair sodden along one side where it had soaked up spilled ale. Her snores droned through the wood of the table like 100 pine beetles devouring a sick tree.
And look, we found her. Only she was in no shape to lead her squad. In fact, she's in no shape for anything. She could get mugged, raped, even murdered. We needed to stand guard.
Stormy belched and scratched at his beard.
It wasn't a fun dream, that's all.
When was the last fun dream you remember having?
Don't know. Been some time, I think. But maybe we just forget those ones. Maybe we only remember the bad ones.
Gessler refilled their tankards.
So there's a storm coming. Impressive subtlety, your dreams. Prophetic, even. You sleep to the whispers of the gods, Stormy.
Now ain't you in a good mood, Guess? Remind me not to talk about my dreams no more.
I didn't want you talking about them this time round. It was the scream.
Not a scream, like I told you. It was a howl.
What's the difference?
Scowling, Stormy reached for his tankard.
Only sometimes, maybe, gods don't whisper.
Furry women still haunting your dreams?
Bottle opened his eyes and contemplated throwing a knife into her face. Instead, he slowly winked.
Good afternoon, Captain. I'm surprised you're not... Excuse me, soldier, but did you just wink at me?
He sat up on his cot.
Was that a wink, Captain? Are you sure?
Faridan Salt turned away, muttering under her breath as she marched towards the barracks door. Once the door shut behind her, Bottle sat back, frowning. Now, messing with an officer's head was just, well, second nature. No, what disturbed him was the fact that he was suddenly unsure if she'd spoken at all. As a question, it didn't seem a likely fit, not coming from Faridan Salt. In fact, he doubted she even knew anything about his particular curse. How could she? There wasn't a fool alive who confided in an officer, especially ones who viciously killed talented, happily married scorpions for no good reason. And if she did indeed know something, then it meant someone had traded that bit of information in exchange for something else. A favor, a deal, which was nothing less than a behind-the-back betrayal of every common soldier in the Legion. Who was vile enough to do that? He opened his eyes and looked around. He was alone in the barracks. Fiddler had taken the squad out for that field exercise, the war game against Bryce Bedick's newly assembled battalions. Complaining of a bad stomach, Bottle had whined and groaned his way out of it. Not for him some useless trudging through bush and farmland. Besides, it hadn't been so long ago that they were killing Lethary for real. There was a good chance someone, on either side, would forget that everyone was friends now. The point was, he'd been the first one quick enough with the bad stomach complaint so no one else could take it up. He'd caught the vicious glare from Smiles, which of course he'd long got used to since he was always faster off the mark than she was.
Smiles.
Bottle fixed his gaze on her cot, studied it through a suspicious squint. Behind the back shit was her forte, wasn't it? Aye, and who else had it in for him? He swung his feet to the floor and, gods, that stone was cold, padded over to her berth. It paid to approach these things cautiously. If anyone was in the habit of rigging booby traps to just about everything they didn't want anyone else to touch, it was that spitting half-mad kitten with the sharp eye stickers. Bottle drew his eating knife and began probing under the thin mattress, leaning close to peer at seams and seemingly random projections of tick straw, any one of which could be coated in poison. Projections which, he discovered, turned out to be, random projections of tick straw.
Trying to lull me into something. I can smell it.
He knelt and peeked under the frame. Nothing obvious, and that made him even more suspicious. Muttering, Bottle crawled round to kneel in front of her lockbox. Lethary issue, not something they'd be taking with them. She'd not have had much time to rig it, not deviously, anyway. No, the needles and blades would be poorly hidden. She'd sold him out, but she would learn to regret doing that. Finding nothing on the outside of the trunk, he slipped his knife point into the lock and began working the mechanism. Discovering that the lockbox wasn't even locked froze him into a long moment of terror. Breath held, sudden sweat beading his forehead.
A snare, for sure. A killer snare. Smiles doesn't invite people in. Oh no, not her. If I just lift this lid, I'm a dead man.
He whirled upon hearing the scrape of boots and found himself looking up at Korab Billan Thenoalis.
Hood's breath, soldier, stop sneaking up on me like that.
What are you doing? Korab asked.
Me? What are you doing? Don't tell me the scrap's already over.
No, I lost my new sword. Sergeant got mad and sent me home.
Bad luck, Korab. No glory for you.
Wasn't looking for any. Wasn't real fighting, Bottle. I don't see the point in that. They'd only learn anything if we could use our weapons and kill a few hundred of them.
Right, that makes sense.
Bring it up with Fiddler. I did, just before he sent me back.
He's getting more unreasonable by the day.
Funny, Korab said. That's exactly what I said to him. Anyway, what are you doing? This isn't your bunk.
You're a sharp one, all right, Korab. See, it's like this. Smiles is trying to murder me.
Is she? Why?
Women like her don't need reasons, Korab. She's set booby traps. Poison is my guess. Because I was staying behind, you see. She's set a trap to kill me.
Oh, said Korab. That's clever. Not clever enough, friend, because now you're here.
I am, yes.
Bottle edged back from the lockbox.
It's unlocked, he said. So I want you to lift the lid.
Korab stepped past and flung the lid back. After he'd recovered from his flinch, Bottle crawled up for a look inside.
Now what? Korab asked behind him. Was that practice?
Practice?
Aye.
No, Korab. Gods, this is strange. Look at this gear. Those clothes. Well, what I meant was, do you want me to open Smiles's box next?
What?
That's Cuttle's. You're at Cuttle's bunk, Bottle. He pointed. Hers is right there.
Well,
Bottle muttered as he stood up and dropped the lid on the lockbox.
That explains the codpiece.
Oh, does it?
They stared at each other.
So just how many bastards do you think you've sired by now?
What?
What?
You just say something, Korab?
What?
Before that.
Before what?
Something about bastards.
Are you calling me a bastard?
Korab demanded, his face darkening.
No, of course not. How would I know?
How? It's none of my business, right?
Bottle slapped the man on one solid shoulder and set off to find his boots.
I'm going out. Thought you were sick. Better now.
Once he'd made his escape, in all likelihood narrowly avoiding being beaten to death by the squad's biggest fist over some pathetic misunderstanding, Bottle glared up at the mid-afternoon sun for a moment and then set off.
All right, you parasite. I'm paying attention now. Where to?
It's about time. I was having doubts.
Quick, Ben. Since when were you playing around with Mokra? And do you have any idea how our skulls will ache by this evening?
Relax. I got something for that. Bottle, I need you to go to the old palace. I'm down in the crypts.
Where you belong.
First time anybody's expressed that particular sentiment, Bottle. Tell me when you get to the grounds.
What are you doing in the crypts, Quick Ben?
I'm at the Sedents. You need to see this, Bottle.
Did you find them, then?
Who?
Sin and Grub. Heard they went missing.
No, they're not here. And no sign that anyone's been down here in some time. As I've already told the adjunct, the two imps are gone.
Gone? Gone where?
No idea, but they're gone.
Bad news for the adjunct. She's losing her mages.
She's got me. She doesn't need anyone else.
And all my fears are laid to rest.
You may not have realized, Bottle, but I was asking you about your furry lover for a reason.
Jealousy?
Hurry up and get here so I can throttle you. No, not jealousy. Although, come to think on it, I can't even recall the last time.
You said you had a reason, Quick Ben. Let's hear it.
What's Dead Smell been telling you?
What? Nothing. Well,
ha! I knew it. Don't believe him, Bottle. He hasn't any idea at all, about what's in the works.
You know, Quick Ben, oh, never mind. So I'm on the grounds. Where to now?
Anybody see you?
You didn't tell me to do this sneakily.
Anybody in sight?
Bottle looked round. Wings of the old palace were settled deep in mud, plaster cracking or simply gone, to reveal fissured, slumping brick walls. Snarls of grasses swallowed up old flagstone pathways. A plaza of some sort off to his left was now a shallow pond. The air was filled with spinning insects.
No.
Good. Now follow my instructions precisely, Bottle.
You sure? I mean, I was planning on ignoring every third direction you gave me.
Fiddler needs to have a few words with you, soldier, about rules of conduct when it comes to high mages.
Look, Quick Ben, if you want me to find this Sedents, leave me to it. I have a nose for those kinds of things.
I knew it.
You knew what? I'm just saying,
she's been whispering in your ear.
Gods below, Quick Ben. The noises she makes aren't whispers. They're not even words. I don't...
She gives you visions, doesn't she? Flashes of her own memories, scenes.
How do you know that?
Tell me some.
Why do you think it's any of your business?
Choose one, damn you!
He slapped at a mosquito. Some would be easier than others, he knew. Easier because they were empty of meaning. Most memories were, he suspected, frozen scenes, jungle trails, the bark of four-legged monkeys from cliff sides, huddled warmth in the night as hunting beasts coughed in the darkness. But there was one that returned again and again, in innumerable variations. The sudden blossoming of blue sky, an opening ahead, the smell of salt, soft rush of gentle waves on white coral beach, padding breathless onto the strand in a chorus of excited cries and chatter, culmination of terrifying journeys overland where it seemed home would never again find them. And then, in sudden gift,
shorelines, quick, bright sun, hot sand underfoot, coming home, even when the home has never been visited before. And all at once they gather to begin building boats.
Boats?
Always boats, islands, places where the tawny hunters do not stalk the night, places where they can be safe.
The heiress
lived for the seas, the oceans. Coming from the great continents, they existed in a state of flight. Shorelines fed them. The vast emptiness beyond the reefs called to them.
Boats? What kind of boats?
It varies. I don't always travel with the same group. Dugouts, reed boats and bamboo rafts, skins, baskets bridged by saplings, like nests in toppled trees. Quick, Ben, the Aerosol, they were smart, smarter than you might think. They weren't as different from us as they might seem. They conquered the entire world.
So what happened to them?
Bottle shrugged. I don't know. I think maybe we happened to them.
He had found a sundered doorway, walking the length of dark, damp corridors and following the narrow staircases spiraling downward to landings ankle-deep in water. Sloshing this way and that, drawing unerringly closer to that pulsing residue of ancient power.
Houses, tiles, holds, wandering. That all sounds simple enough, doesn't it, Quick Ben? Logical. But what about the roads of the sea? Where do they fit in? Or the siren calls of the wind? The point is, we see ourselves as the great trekkers, the bold travellers and explorers. But the Aerosol, High Mage, they did it first. There isn't a place we step anywhere in this world that they haven't stepped first. Humbling thought, isn't it?
He reached a narrow tunnel with an uneven floor that formed islands between pools. A massive portal with a leaning lintel stone beckoned. He stepped through and saw the causeway and the broader platform at the end, where stood Quick Ben.
All right, I'm here, Quick Ben, with soaked feet.
The vast chamber was bathed in golden light that rose like mist from the tiles spreading out from the disc. Quick Ben, head tilted to one side, watched Bottle approach up the causeway, an odd look in his eyes.
What?
He blinked and then gestured.
Look around, Bottle. The Sedence is alive.
Signifying what?
I was hoping you could tell me. The magic here should be waning. We've unleashed the Warrens, after all. We've brought the deck of dragons. We've slammed the door on chaos. It's like bringing the wheel to a tribe that has only used sleds and travoy. There's been a revolution among the kingdom's mages. Even the priests are finding everything upside down. It'd be nice to sneak a spy into the cult of the errant. Anyway, this place should be dying, Bottle.
Bottle looked round. One tile close by displayed a scatter of bones carved like impressions into the stone surface, impressions that glowed as if filled with embers. Nearby was another showing an empty throne. But the brightest tile of all lifted its own image above the flat surface so that it floated, swirling, in three dimensions. A dragon, wings spread wide, jaws open.
Hurt's breath,
he muttered, repressing a shiver.
Your roads of the sea, Bottle, said Quick Ben. They make me think about mail.
Well, hard not to think about mail in this city, High Mage.
You know, then.
Bottle nodded.
That's not nearly as worrisome as what was happening back in the Malazan Empire. The ascension of Malik Rel, the Gistal.
Bottle frowned at Quick Ben.
How can that be more worrying than finding an elder god standing next to the Lethary throne?
It's not the throne he's standing beside. It's Tehol. From what I gather, that relationship has been there for some time. Male's hiding here, trying to keep his head down. But he hasn't much say when some mortal manages to grasp some of his power and starts forcing concessions.
The Elder God of the Seas, said Bottle, was ever a thirsty god. And his daughter isn't much better.
Beru? Who else? The Lady of Fair Seas is an ironic title. It pays, he added, eyeing the dragon tile, not to take things so literally.
I'm thinking, said Quick Ben, of asking the adjunct to elevate you to High Mage.
Don't do that, snapped Bottle. Give me a reason not to, and not one of those pathetic ones about comradeship and how you're so needed in Fid's squad.
All right. See what you think of this one, then. Keep me where I am, as your shaved knuckle in the hole.
The High Mage's glittering eyes narrowed, and then he smiled.
I may not like you much, Bottle, but sometimes I like what you say.
Lucky you. Now, can we get out of this place?
I think it is time, she said, for us to leave.
Withal squinted at her and then rubbed at the bristle on his chin.
You want better accommodation, love?
No, you idiot. I mean leave. The Bone Hunters, this city, all of it. You did what you had to do. I did what I had to do. My miserable family of rakes runts are gone now. Nothing holds us here anymore. Besides, she added, I don't like where things are going.
That reading.
Meaningless.
She fixed a level gaze on him.
Do I look like the Queen of High House Dark?
Withal hesitated.
Do you value your life, husband?
If you want us to leave, why, I don't expect anyone will try to stop us. We can book passage somewhere.
And then he frowned.
Hold on, Sand. Where will we go?
Scowling, she rose and began pacing round their small, sparsely furnished room.
Remember the Sheikh on that prison island?
Aye, the ones that used old Andy words for some things.
Who worship the shore, yes.
Well, he asked,
who also seemed to think that the shore was dying.
Maybe the one they knew. I mean, there's always some kind of shore.
Rising sea levels.
Aye.
Those sea levels, she continued, now facing the window and looking out over the city, have been kept unnaturally low for a long time.
They have?
Omtos Felak, the rituals of ice, the Jagot and their war with the Talani Mas. The vast ice fields are melting withal.
She faced him.
Your Mekros, you've seen for yourself the storms. We saw it again at Fent Reach. The oceans are in chaos. Seasons are awry. Floods, droughts, infestations. And where does the adjunct want to take our army? East, to Colance. But it's a common opinion here in Letha that Colance is suffering a terrible drought.
Her dark eyes hardened.
Have you ever seen an entire people starving, dying of thirst?
No, have you?
I am old, husband. I remember the Salen Gara, an offshoot Andi people in my home world. They lived in the forests until the forests died. We begged them then to come to Carcanus, to the cities of the realm. They refused. Their hearts were broken, they said. Their world had died, and so they elected to die with it. Andarist begged.
Her gaze clouded then, and she turned away, back to the window.
Yes, withal, to answer you. Yes, I have, and I will not see it again.
Very well. Where to, then?
We will begin, she said, with a visit to the Sheikh.
What have they to tell you, Sand? Garbled memories, ignorant superstitions.
Withal, I fell in battle. We warred with the Kachain Chemal. Until the Tist Edua betrayed us, slaughtered us. Clearly, they were not as thorough as they perhaps should have been. Some Andi survived, and it seems that there were more than just Kachain Chemal dwelling in that region. There were humans.
The Sheikh.
People who had become the Sheikh, once they took in the surviving Andi. Once the myths and legends of both groups knitted together and became indistinguishable.
She paused and then said,
But even then, there must have been a schism of some sort. Unless, of course, the Tist Andi of Blue Rose were an earlier population, a migration distinct from our own. But my thinking is this. Some of the Sheikh, with Tist Andi among them, split away, travelled inland. They were the ones who created Blue Rose, a theocracy centred on the worship of the Black-Winged Lord, on Anamand Orek, Son of Darkness.
Is it not equally possible, ventured Withal, that all the Tist Andi left, leaving just the Sheikh, weakly blood-mixed here and there, perhaps, but otherwise just human, yet now possessing that knitted skein of myths and such?
She glanced at him, frowned.
That's a thought, husband. The Tist Andi survivors used the humans to begin with to regain their strength, to stay alive on this unknown world, even to hide them from Edur hunting parties. And then, when at last they judged they were ready and it was safe, they all left.
But wouldn't the Sheikh have then rejected them, their stories, their words? After all, they certainly didn't worship the Tist Andi, did they? They worshipped the shore, and you have to admit that's one strange religion they have, praying to a strip of beach and whatnot.
And that is what interests me more than those surviving Tist Andi. And that is why I wish to speak with their elders, their witches and warlocks.
Dead Smell described the horrid skeletons his squad and Sin found on the north end of the island. Half reptilian, half human, misbegotten,
that were quickly killed, disposed of. The taint, withal, of Kachain Chemal. And so, before we Tist even arrived, they lived in the shadow of the Chemal. And it was not in isolation, no. There was some form of contact, some kind of relationship. There must have been.
He thought about that, still uncertain as to where her thoughts were taking her. Why it had become so important that she uncover the secrets of the Sheikh.
Sandalath, why did you Tist war against the Kachain Chemal?
She looked startled.
Why? Because they were different.
I see. And they fought against you in turn, because you were different, or because you were invading their world?
She reached up and closed the shutters, blocking out the cityscape and sky beyond. The sudden gloom was like a shroud on their conversation.
I'm going out now, she said. Start packing.
With delicate precision, Telerast nipped at the eyelid, clasping it and lifting it away from the eye. Curdle leaned in for a closer look, then pulled back, hind claws scrabbling to maintain their grip on the front of Banaskar's tunic.
He's pissed drunk, all right. Snuffed candle, doused fire, gutted lamp, the reeking dead.
Telerast released the lid, watched it sink back down. Banaskar sighed wetly, groaned and shifted in the chair, head lolling. The two skeletal creatures scrambled down and rendezvoused on the windowsill on the other side of the small room. They tilted their heads closer together.
What now?
Curdle whispered.
What kind of question is that? What now? What now? Have you lost your mind? Well, what now, Telerast? How should I know? But listen, we need to do something. That errand, he's... Well, I hate him, is what. And worse, he's using Banaskar, our very own ex-priest. Our pet. That's right, our pet, not his. We should kill him. Who, Banaskar or the errand? If we kill Banaskar, then nobody has a pet. If we kill the errand, then we can keep Banaskar all to ourselves. Right, Curdle,
Telerast said, nodding.
But which one would make the errand angrier? Good question. We need something to make him go mad, completely mad. That's the best revenge for stealing our pet. And then we kill him. Who? It doesn't matter. Why are you being so thick? Oh, what a ridiculous question. Listen, Curdle, now we got ourselves a plan, and that's good. It's a start. So let's think some more. Vengeance against the errant. The Elder God. Right. Who's still around? Right. Stealing pets. Curdle, I'm just thinking out loud, that's all. You call that thinking? No wonder we ended up torn to pieces and dead and worse than dead. Oh, and what are you thinking then? I didn't have any time to, since I had to answer all your questions. You always got an excuse, Tellerast. Did you know that? Always. And you're it, Curdle. Did you know that?
A voice croaked from the other side of the room.
What are you two whispering about over there?
The two skeletons flinched, then tail lashing about, Tellerast ducked ahead in Baniskar's direction.
Absolutely nothing, and that's a fact. In fact, beloved pet, that's the problem. Every time, it's Curdle. She's an idiot. She drives me mad. Drives you to drink, too, I bet.
The Errant's game is one of fate, Baniskar said, rubbing at his face. He uses, abuses, proclivities, tendencies. He nudges, pushes over the edge.
He blinked blearily at the two skeletons.
To take him down, you need to take advantage of that selfsame obsession. You need to set a trap.
Tellerast and Curdle hopped down from the sill and advanced on the seated man, tails flicking, heads low.
A trap, whispered Tellerast. That's good. We thought you'd switched gods. That's what we thought. Don't tell him what we thought, Curdle hissed. It doesn't matter now. He's on our side. Weren't you listening?
The Errant wants all he once had, said Baniskar. Temples, worshippers, domination, power. To do that, he needs to take down the gods. The high houses, all in ruins, smoldering heaps. This coming war with the crippled god presents him with his chance. A few nudges on the battlefield, who'd notice? He wants spilled blood, my friends, that's what he wants.
Who doesn't?
Asked Curdle. The two creatures had reached Baniskar's scuffed boots and were now bobbing and fawning.
The chaos of battle, murmured Tellerast. Yes, that would be ideal. For us,
nodded Curdle.
Precisely, our chance.
To do what? Baniskar asked. Find yourselves a couple of thrones?
He snorted. Ignoring them as they prostrated themselves at his feet, he held up his hands and stared at them.
See this tremble, friends? What does it truly signify? I will tell you. I am the last living priest of Derek. Why was I spared? I lost all the privileges of worship within a temple. I lost a secular game of influence and power, diminished in the eyes of my brothers and sisters, in the eyes of everyone, I imagine. But I never gave up worshipping my god.
He squinted.
I should be dead. Was I simply forgotten? Has it taken longer than Derek thought to hunt us all down? When will my god find me?
After a moment longer, he lowered his hands onto his thighs.
I just wait.
Our pet's disenchanted, whispered Tellerast. That's bad,
Curdle whispered back.
We need to find him a woman, or a child to eat. They don't eat children, Curdle. Well, some other kind of treat then. A bottle. A bottle, yes, that's good.
They went hunting. Baniskar waited. Koryk trained his crossbow on the back of the scout's helmed head, his finger edged down to the iron press. The point of a knife hovered into view opposite his right eye.
I got orders, whispered Smiles, to kill you if you kill anyone.
He drew his finger back.
Like hood you have. Besides, it might be an accident.
Oh, I saw that for sure, Koryk. Your trigger finger just accidentally slipping down like that. And then, oh, in went my knife point. Another accident. Tragedies! We'll burn you on a pyre seti style, and that's a promise.
He lowered the crossbow and rolled onto his side, out of sight of the clumsy scout on the track below.
Right. That makes perfect sense, Smiles. A pyre for the people who live on the grasslands. We like our funerals to involve, why, everyone. We burn down whole villages and scorch the ground for leagues in every direction.
She blinked at him and then shrugged.
Whatever you do with your dead, then.
He worked his way down the slope, Smiles following.
My turn, she said when they reached the draw. Get back up there.
You waited till we got down here to say that?
She grinned. Leaving him to scrabble back into position, Smiles set off through the brush. It wasn't that the leathery scouts were especially bad. It was more the case that their tradition of warfare kept them trapped in the idea of huge armies clashing on open fields, where scouts were employed simply to find the enemy encampments. The notion of a foe that could melt into the landscape the way the Malazans could, or even the idea that the enemy might split its forces, avoid direct clashes, and whittle the Lethary down with raids, ambushes, and disrupted supply lines, none of that was part of their military thinking. The Tist Edur had been tougher by far. Their fighting style was much closer to the Malazan one, which probably explained why the Edur conquered the Lethary the first time round. Of course, the Malazans could stand firm in a big scrap, but it made sense to have spent some time demoralizing and weakening their foe beforehand. These Lethary had a lot still to learn. After all, one day the Malazans might be back. Not the Bone Hunters, but the Imperial armies of the Empress. A new kingdom to conquer, a new continent to subjugate. If King Tehol wanted to hold on to what he had, his brother had better be commanding a savvy, nasty army that knew how to face down Malazan marines, heavies, squad mages, sappers with munitions, and decent cavalry. She quietly grunted as she approached the hidden camp.
Poor Bryce Bedict. They might as well surrender now.
If you was any less ugly, a voice said, I'd have killed you for sure.
She halted, scowling.
Take your time announcing yourself, Pickett.
The soldier that edged into view was dark-skinned, barring a piebald blotch of pink disfiguring half his face and most of his forehead. The heavy crossbow in his hands was cocked, but no quarrel rested in the slot. Smiles pushed past him.
Talk about ugly. You live in my nightmares, Gullstream, you know that?
The man stepped in behind her.
Can't help being so popular with the ladies, he said. Especially the Lethary ones.
Despite the blotch, there was indeed something about Gullstream that made women take a second and third look. She suspected he might have some Tist Andi blood in his veins, the almond-shaped eyes that never seemed to settle on any one colour, his way of moving, as if he had all the time in the world, and the fact that he was, according to rumour, well hung. Shaking her head to clear away stupid thoughts, she said,
Their scouts have gone right past, staying on the track mostly, so the fist can move us all up. We'll fall on the main column, screaming our lungs out, and that will be that.
As she was saying this, they entered the camp, a few hundred soldiers sitting or lying quietly amidst the trees, stumps, and brush. Seeing Keneb, Smiles headed over to make her report. The fist was sitting on a folding camp stool, using the point of his dagger to scrape mud from the soles of his boots. A cup of steaming herbal tea rested on a stump beside him. Sprawled on the ground a few paces away was Sergeant Fiddler, and just beyond him Sergeant Balm sat cross-legged, studying the short sword he was holding, his expression confused. A dozen heavies waited nearby, grouped together and seeming to be engaged in comparing their outthrust hands.
Counting knuckle hairs, I bet.
Fist, Scout Smiles reporting, sir.
Keneb glanced up.
As predicted? Aye, sir. Can we go kill 'em all now?
The fist looked over at Fiddler.
Looks like you lost your bet, Sergeant.
Eyes still closed, Fiddler grunted, then said,
We ain't done any killing yet, sir. Bryce Bedict's been fishing in our brains for some time now. He's bound to have snagged a fin or gill or two. Smiles, how many scouts on the track?
Just the one, Sergeant, picking his nose.
Fiddler opened his eyes and squinted over at Keneb.
Like that, Fist. Bedict's reconfigured his scouting patrols. They pair up. If Smiles and Corrick saw only one, then where was the other one?
He shifted to get more comfortable and closed his eyes again.
And he runs 5 units, 5 pairs, in advance of his main body. So,
repeated Keneb, frowning. He rose, slipped the dagger into his scabbard.
If he sent one or two down the track, they were meant to be seen. Sergeant Balm, find me that map.
Map, sir? What map?
Muttering under his breath, Keneb walked over to the heavies.
You there. Yes, you. Name?
Relico, sir.
What are you doing with those heavies, Relico?
Why, 'cause I am one, sir.
Watching this, Smiles snorted. The top of Relico's gnarly head barely reached her shoulder. The man looked like a prune with arms and legs.
Who's your sergeant? Keneb asked the Dalhanese soldier.
Badan Gruk, sir.
But he stayed back sick, sir, along with Sergeant Sinter and Kissware. Me and Vastly Blank here, we squadding up with Drawfirst and Sholey under Sergeant Primley, sir.
Very well. Go into the command tent and bring me the map.
Aye, sir. You want the table with it?
No, that won't be necessary. As the soldier walked off, Fiddler said, Could have been there and back by now, sir, all by yourself. I could have, yes. And just for that observation, Sergeant, go and get that map table for me. Thought it wasn't necessary, sir. I changed my mind. On your feet. Groaning, Fiddler sat up, nudged Balm and said, You and me, we got work to do. Blinking, Balm stared at him a moment. Then he leapt upright, sword in his hand.
Where are they, then?
Follow me, Fiddler said, climbing to his feet, and put that thing away before you poke me with it.
Why would I stab you? I mean, I know you, right?
I think.
Aye, I know you.
They passed Relico on their way to the tent. As the soldier stepped up, Keneb took the rolled-up hide.
Thank you. Relico, before you go, a question. Why are all the heavies examining their hands?
We was adding up lost bits, sir, to see if it made up a whole hand.
Does it?
We're missing a thumb, but we heard there's a heavy without any thumbs. Might be over in Blistig's Legion.
Indeed, and what would his name be?
Nefarious Bread, sir.
And how would this soldier be able to wield any weapons without thumbs?
Relico shrugged.
Can't say, sir, as I only seen him once, and that was from too far away. I expect he ties him up, sort of, somehow.
Perhaps, ventured Keneb, he's missing only one thumb. Shield hand, perhaps.
Might be, sir, might be. In which case, as soon as we find a thumb, why, we'll let him know.
Relico returned to his companions. Keneb stared after the soldier, frowning.
Kingdoms toppled one by one, said Smiles, because of soldiers like him, sir. Keep telling yourself that. That's how I do it.
Do what, Scout?
Stay sane, sir. He's the one, you know.
Who? What?
The shortest heavy in the history of the Malazan Empire, sir.
Really? Are you certain of that, Scout?
Sir?
But he'd unfurled the map and was now studying it. Fiddler and Balm were approaching, a heavy table between them. As soon as they arrived, Keneb rolled up the map and set it on the tabletop.
You can take that back now, sergeants. Thank you.
Smiles jogged her way back to where Corrick was hidden along the ridge. Behind her clunked Corporal Tarr, sounding like a damned tinker's cart. She shot him a glare over one shoulder.
You should have strapped down. You know that, don't you?
This is a damned feint, said Tarr. What difference does it make?
They reached the base of the ridge.
I'll wait here. Go collect the fool, Smiles, and be quick about it.
Biting back a retort, she set off up the slope. It'd be different, she knew, if she was the corporal. And this was a perfect example. If she was corporal, it'd be Tarr doing this climb, and that was a fact. Corrick heard her coming and worked his way down to meet her.
No column, huh?
No. How'd you guess?
Didn't have to. I waited. And no column.
They descended the slope side by side to where Tarr waited.
We lost the enemy, corporal?
Something like that, Corrick. And now the fists got us on the move. We're going to be buggered trying catch-up, too. He's now thinking we've stuck our heads in a wasp nest.
These leathery couldn't turn an ambush on us, Corrick pronounced. We would have sniffed it out by now.
But we didn't, Smiles pointed out. We've been flushed, Corrick.
Lazy, pronounced Tarr. Overconfident. Fiddler was right.
Of course he was, said Smiles. He's Fiddler. It's always the problem. The people in charge never listen to the people in the know. It's like two different worlds, two different languages.
She stopped when she noticed both men looking at her.
What?
Nothing, said Tarr, except, well, that was a sharp observation there, Smiles.
Oh, and did that shock you too?
Shocked me, admitted Corrick.
She scowled at him. But secretly she was pleased.
That's right. I ain't the fool you think I am. I ain't the fool nobody thinks I am. Everybody, I mean. Well, they're the real fools anyway.
They hurried on, but long before they caught up to the company, it was all over. The leathery ambush caught Keneb's mob coming down a forested slope that funneled before reaching the basin. Enemy ranks rose up on both sides from fast-dug foxholes and loosed a few hundred unfletched arrows with soft clay balls instead of barbed iron points. If the flights had been real, half the Malazans would have been downed, dead or wounded. A few more salvos and most of the rest would be out of commission. Bryce Bedict made an appearance in the midst of leathery catcalls and cheering, walking up to Fist Keneb and painting with one dripping finger a red slash across his boiled leather cuirass.
"Sorry, Fist, but you have just been wiped out."
"Indeed, Commander," Keneb acknowledged. 300 dead bone hunters cut down in a pocket. Very well done, although I suspect it highlights a lesson as yet undiscovered."
The smile on Bryce's face faded slightly.
"Fist, I'm afraid I don't understand you.
Sometimes one's tactics must prove brutal in the execution, Commander, especially when the timing's off and nothing can be done for it."
"I'm sorry."
Horns sounded suddenly from the ridgelines beyond the leathery units, on all sides, in fact.
Keneb said, 300 dead bone hunters, Commander, and 800 dead leathery, including their supreme commander. Not an ideal exchange for either side, but in a war, probably one the adjunct could stomach."
Bryce sighed, his expression wry.
"Lesson delivered, Fist Keneb. My compliments to the adjunct."
At that moment, Fiddler walked up to them.
"Fist, you owe me and my squad 2 nights' leave, sir."
Keneb grinned at Bryce Bedict.
"As much as the adjunct would appreciate the compliments, Commander, they in fact belong to this sergeant here."
"Ah, I see."
"That's another lesson to mull over," Keneb said. "The one about listening to your veterans, regardless of rank." "Well," mused Bryce, "I may have to go hunting for my few surviving veterans, then. Nonetheless, Fist, the sacrifice of 300 of your soldiers strikes me as a loss you can ill afford, regardless of the battle's outcome."
"True. Hence my comment about timing, Commander. I sent a rider to Fist Blistig, but we could not respond in time to your ambush. Obviously, I would rather have avoided all contact with your troops. But since I know we'd all prefer to sleep in real beds tonight, I thought it more instructive to invite the engagement. Now," he added, smiling, "we can all march back to Letharus."
Bryce drew out a handkerchief, wetted it from his canteen, and then stepped up to Fist Keneb and carefully cleaned off the streak of red paint. Captain Faradan Sort entered Kindly's office to find her counterpart standing to one side of his desk and staring down at an enormous mound of what looked like hair heaped on the desktop.
"Gods below, what is that?"
Kindly glanced over.
"What does it look like?"
"Hair."
"Correct. Animal hair, as best as I can determine. A variety of domestic beasts."
"It reeks. What is it doing on your desk?"
"Good question. Tell me, was Lieutenant Pawes in the outer office?"
She shook her head.
"No one there, I'm afraid."
He grunted.
"Hiding, I expect."
"I doubt he'd do something like this, Kindly."
"Oh, never directly, no. But I would wager a wagon load of Imperials he's had a hand in it. He imagines himself very clever, does my lieutenant."
"If he owns anything he values greatly," she said, "crush it under a heel. That's how I took care of the one I sensed was going to give me trouble. That was back in Seven Cities, and to this day he looks at me with hurt in his eyes."
He glanced at her.
"Hurt? Truly?"
"Truly."
"That's exceptional advice, Faradan. Thank you."
"You're welcome. Anyway, I was coming by to see if you'd had any better luck finding our 2 wayward mages."
"No, we need to get High Mage Quick Ben involved in the search, I believe. Assuming," he added, "they're worth finding."
She turned away, walked to the window.
"Kindly, Sin saved many, many lives at Yagatan. She did so the night of the assault and again with the survivors under the city. Her brother, Corporal Shard, is beside himself with worry. She is precipitous, yes, but I do not consider that necessarily a fault."
"And the adjunct has, it seems, desperate need for mages," said Kindly.
Why is that? She shrugged.
I know as little as you, kindly. We will march soon, away from the comforts of Letharus.
The man grunted. Never let a soldier get too comfortable. Leads to trouble every time. She's right in kicking us into motion. Still, it would be a comfort to know what we're heading into.
And a greater comfort to have more than one half-mad high mage to support 8,000 soldiers.
She paused and then said,
We won't find ourselves another beak hiding among the squads. We've had our miracle, kindly.
You're starting to sound as grim as Blistig. She shook herself.
You're right. Apologies. I'm just worried about Sin, that's all.
Then find Quick Ben. Get him looking into those closets, or whatever they're called.
Warrens.
Right. Sighing, she swung round and went to the door.
I'll send Pors to you if I see him.
You won't, kindly said. He'll come up for air sooner or later, Faradan. Leave the lieutenant to me. Sergeant Sinter and her sister sat playing the Dalhanese version of Bones with Badan Gruk. The human finger bones were polished with use, gleaming amber. The legend was that they'd belonged to three Li Heng traders who'd come to the village only to be caught thieving. They'd lost more than their hands, naturally. Dalhanese weren't much interested in delivering lessons. They preferred something more succinct, and besides, executing the fools just left the path open for more to come wandering in, and everyone liked a good torture session. That was before things got civilized, of course. Kellenved had put an end to torture. A state that employs torture invites barbarism and deserves nothing better than to suffer the harvest of its own excesses. That was said to have been from the Emperor himself, although Sinter had her doubts. Sounded too literate, especially for a damned Dalhanese thief. Anyway, life stopped being much fun once civilization arrived, or so the old ones muttered. But then they were always muttering. It was the last career to take up before dying of oldness. The reward for living so long, she supposed. She didn't expect to survive her career as a soldier. It was interesting to see how it was the green fresh ones who did all the complaining. The veterans just stayed quiet. So maybe all that bitching was at both ends of life, the young and the old trapped inside chronic dissatisfaction. Kisware collected up the bones and tossed them again.
Ha! Poor Badan Gruk. You won't ever match that. Let's see you try.
It was a pretty good cast, Sinter had to acknowledge. Four of the core patterns, with only a couple of spars missing and one true bridge. Badan would need a near-perfect throw to top Kisware's run.
I'll stop there, I said. Toss him, Badan, and no cheating.
I don't cheat, he said as he collected up the bones.
Then what's that you just palmed?
Badan opened his hand and scowled.
This one's gummed. No wonder you got those casts.
If it was gummed, Kisware retorted, then it was from my sister's last throw. Hood's breath, sighed Sinter. Look, you fools, we're all cheating. It's in our blood. So now we've got to accept the fact that none of us is going to admit they were the one using the gum to get a stick. Clean the thing off and let's get on with it.
The others subsided and Sinter was careful to hide her relief. That damned gum had been in her pouch too long, making it dirty, and she could feel the stuff on her fingers. She surreptitiously brought her hands down to her thighs and rubbed as if trying to warm up. Kisware shot her a jaded look. The damned barracks was hot as a head-shrinker's oven. They made a point of ignoring the clump of boots as someone marched up to their table. Badan Gruk threw the bones and achieved 6 out of 6 in the core.
Did you see that? Look!
Badan's smile was huge and hugely fake.
Look, you two, look at that cast!
But they were looking at him instead, because cheaters couldn't stand that for long. They'd twitch, they'd bead up, they'd squirrel on the chair.
Look!
He said again, pointing, but the command sounded more like a plea, and all at once he sagged back and raised his hands.
Fingers clean, darlings!
That would be a first, said the man standing now at their table.
Badan Gruk's expression displayed hurt and innocence, with just a touch of indignation.
That wasn't called for, sir. You saw my throw. You can see my fingers, too. Clean as clean can be. No gum, no tar, no wax. Soldiers can't be smelly or dirty. It's bad for morale.
You sure about that? Cinta twisted in her chair.
Can we help you, Lieutenant Paws?
The man's eyes flickered in surprise. You mistake me, Sergeant Cinta. I am Captain.
Kindly was pointed out to us, sir.
I thought I ordered you to cut your hair.
We did, said Kisware. It grew back. It's a trait among Dalhunnies. Right in the blood, an aversion. Is that the word, Sint? Sure it is, aversion. To bad haircuts. We get them and our hair insists on growing back to what looks better. Happens overnight, sir.
You might be comfortable, said Paws, believing that I'm not Captain Kindly, that I'm not, in fact, the man who was pointed out to you. But can you be certain that the right one was pointed out to you? If Lieutenant Paws was doing the pointing, for example? He's one for jokes and bad taste, infamous for it, in fact. He could have elected to take advantage of you. It's a trait of his, one suspects, in the blood, as it were.
So, asked Cinta, who might he have pointed to, sir?
Why, anyone at all.
But Lieutenant Paws isn't a woman now, is she?
Of course not, but...
It was a woman, continued Cinta, who did the pointing out.
Ah, but she might have been pointing to Lieutenant Paws, since you asked about whoever was your immediate superior. Well, said Paws, now that that's cleared up, I need to check if you two women have put on the weight you were ordered to. Kisware and Cinta both leaned back to regard him. The man gave them a bright smile.
Sir, said Cinta, how precisely do you intend to do that?
The smile was replaced by an expression of shock. Do you imagine your captain to be some dirty old codger, Sergeant? I certainly hope not. No, you will come to my office at the 9th bell tonight. You will strip down to your undergarments in the outer office. When you are ready, you are to knock, and upon hearing my voice, you are to enter immediately. Am I understood, soldiers?
Yes, sir, said Cinta.
Until then. The officer marched off.
How long, asked Kisware after he'd left the barracks, are we going to run with this, Cint? Early days yet, she smiled, collecting the bones. Badan, since you're out of the game for being too obvious, I need you to do a chore for me. Well, not much of a chore. Anyway, I need you to go out into the city and find me two of the fattest, ugliest whores you can.
I don't like where this is all going, Badan Gruk muttered.
Listen to you, chided Cinta. You're getting old.
What did she say?
Sandalath Drukolat scowled.
She wondered why we'd waited so long.
Withal grunted.
That woman, Sand.
Yes.
She paused just inside the doorway and glared at the three Nachts huddled beneath the windowsill. Their long, black, muscled arms were wrapped about one another, forming a clump of limbs and torsos from which three blunt heads made an uneven row, eyes thinned and darting with suspicion.
What's with them?
I think they're coming with us, Withal replied. Only, of course, they don't know where we're going.
Tie them up. Lock them up. Do something. Just keep them here, husband. They're grotesque.
They are not my pets, he said.
She crossed her arms.
Really? Then why do they spend all their time under your feet?
Honestly, I have no idea.
Who do they belong to?
He studied them for a long moment. Not one of the Nachts would meet his eyes. It was pathetic.
Withal?
All right. I think they're males, pets.
Male?
I was praying to him, you see. And they showed up on the island. Or maybe they showed up before I started praying. I can't recall. But they got me off that island, and that was Male's doing.
Then send them back to him.
That doesn't seem to be the way praying works, Sand.
Mother bless us, she sighed, striding forward. Pack up.
We're leaving tonight.
Tonight? It'll be dark sand.
She gave him the same glare she'd given Rind, Puel, and Mape.
Dark, aye. Never mind.
The worst of it was, in turning away, he caught the looks of sympathy in the Nacht's beady eyes, tracking him like mourners at a funeral.
Well, a man learns to take sympathy where he can get it. If this is a new warren, whispered Grubb, then I think I'd rather we kept the old ones.
Sin was quiet, as she had been for most of what must have been an entire day, maybe longer, as they wandered this terrible world. Windswept desert stretched out in all directions. The road they walked cut across it straight as a spear. Here and there, off to one side, they spied fields of stones that might have once been dwellings, and the remnants of sun-fired mudbrick pen or garden walls, but nothing grew here, nothing at all. The air was acrid, smelling of burning pitch, and that was not too surprising as black pillars of smoke stalked the horizons. On the road itself, constructed of crushed rock and possibly glass, they came upon scenes of devastation, burnt-out hulks of carriages and wagons, scorched clothing and shattered furniture. Fire-blackened corpses, limbs curled like tree roots and hands like bird feet, mouths agape and hollow sockets staring at the empty sky. Twisted pieces of metal lay scattered about, none remotely identifiable to Grubb. Breathing made his throat sore, and the bitter chill of the morning had given way to blistering heat. Eyes stinging, feet dragging, he followed in Sin's wake until her shadow lengthened to a stretched-out shape painted in pitch, and to his eyes it was as if he was looking down upon the woman she would one day become. He realized that his fear of her was growing, and her silence was making it worse.
"Will you now be mute to me as well?" he asked her.
She glanced back over her shoulder momentarily. It would soon grow cold again. He'd lost too much fluid to survive a night of shivering.
"We need to camp, Sin. Make a fire."
She barked a laugh, but did not turn round.
"Fire," she said. "Yes, fire. Tell me, Grubb, what do you believe in?"
"What?"
"Some things are more real than others. For everyone. Each one different, always different. What's the most real to you?"
"We can't survive this place. That's what's most real, Sin. We need water, food, shelter."
He saw her nod.
"That's what this warren is telling us, Grubb. Just that. What you believe has to do with surviving. It doesn't go any further, does it? What if I told you that it used to be that for almost everybody? Before the cities, before people invented being rich?"
"Being rich? I don't know what you're talking about."
"Before some people found other things to believe in. Before they made those things more real than anything else. Before they decided it was all right even to kill for them, or enslave people, or keep them stupid and poor."
She shot him a look.
"Did you know I had a Tano tutor, a spirit walker?"
"I don't know anything about them. Seven cities priests, right?"
"He once told me that an untethered soul can drown in wisdom."
"What?"
"Wisdom grows by stripping away beliefs until the last tether is cut, and suddenly you float free. Only because your eyes are wide open, you see right away that you can't float in what you're in. You can only sink. That's why the meanest religions work so hard at keeping their followers ignorant. Knowledge is poison. Wisdom is depthless. Staying ignorant keeps you in the shallows. Every Tano one day takes a final spirit walk. They cut the last tether, and the soul can't go back. When that happens, the other Tenos mourn, because they know that the spirit walker has drowned."
His mouth was too dry, his throat too sore, but even if that had been otherwise, he knew he would have nothing to say to any of that. He knew, after all, about his own ignorance.
"Look around, Grubb. See? There are no gifts here. Look at these stupid bodies in their stupid wagon loads of furniture. The last thing that was real for them, the only thing, was fire."
His attention was drawn to a dust cloud, rising in a slanted shroud of gold. Something was on a track that would converge with this road, A herd? An army?
Fire is not the gift you think it is, Grub.
We'll die tonight without it.
We need to stay on this road.
Why?
To find out where it leads.
We'll die here, then.
This land, Grub, she said, has generous memories.
The sun was low by the time the army arrived, horse-drawn chariots and massive wagons burdened with plunder. The warriors were dark-skinned, tall and thin, bedecked in bronze armor. Grub thought there might be 1,000 of them, maybe more. He saw spearmen, archers, and what must be the equivalent of heavy infantry, armed with sickle-bladed axes and short curved swords. They cut across the track of the road as if blind to it, and as Grub stared, he was startled to realize that the figures in their horses and chariots were vaguely transparent.
They are ghosts. These, he said to Sin, who stood beside him, are this land's memories?
Yes.
Can they see us?
She pointed at one chariot that had thundered past only to turn round at the urging of the man behind the driver and was now drawing up opposite them.
See him? He's a priest. He can't see us, but he senses us. Holiness isn't always in a place, Grub. Sometimes it's what's passing through.
He shivered, hugged himself.
Stop this, Sin. We're not gods.
No, we're not. We're, and she laughed, more like divine messengers.
The priest had leapt down from the chariot. Grub could now see the old blood splashed across the spokes of the high wheels, and saw where blades were fitted in times of battle, projecting out from the hubs. A mass charge by such instruments of war would deliver terrible slaughter. The hawk-faced man was edging closer, groping like a blind man. Grub made to step back, but Sin caught him by the arm and held him fast.
Don't, she murmured. Let him touch the divine, Grub. Let him receive his gift of wisdom.
The priest had raised his hands. Beyond, the entire army had halted, and Grub saw what must be a king or commander, perched on a huge, ornate chariot, drawing up to observe the strange antics of his priest.
We can give him no wisdom, Grub said. Sin!
Don't be a fool. Just stand here. Wait. We don't have to do anything.
Those two outstretched hands came closer. The palms were speckled with dried blood. There were, however, no calluses upon them. Grub hissed.
He is no warrior.
No, Sin agreed. But he so likes the blood.
The palms hovered, slipped forward, and unerringly settled upon their brows. Grub saw the priest's eyes widen, and he knew at once that the man was seeing through to this road and its litter of destruction, to an age either long before or yet to come. The age in which Grub and Sin existed, solid and real. The priest lurched back and howled. Sin's laughter was harsh.
He saw what was real. He saw.
She spun to face Grub, her eyes bright.
The future is a desert and a road, and no end to the stupid wars, the insane slaughter.
She whirled back and jabbed a finger at the wailing priest who was staggering back to his chariot.
He believed in the sun god. He believed in immortality, of glory, of wealth, golden fields, lush gardens, sweet rains and sweet rivers flowing without cease. He believed his people are, ha, chosen. They all do, don't you see? They do, we do, everyone does. See our gift, Grub? See what knowledge yields him? The sanctuary of ignorance is shattered. Garden into wilderness, cast out into the seas of wisdom. Is not our message divine?
Grub did not think he had any tears left in him. He was wrong. The army and its priest and its king all fled, wild as the wind. But before they did, slaves appeared and raised a cairn of stones, which they then surrounded with offerings, jars of beer and wine and honey, dates, figs, loaves of bread and 2 throat-cut goats spilling blood into the sand. The feast was ghostly, but Sin assured Grub that it would sustain them. Divine gifts, she said, were not gifts at all. The receiver must pay for them.
And he has done that, has he not, Grub? Oh, he has done that.
The errant stepped into the vast, impossible chamber. Gone now the leisure of reminiscences, the satisfied stirring of brighter days long since withered, colourless, almost dead. Knuckles trailed a step behind him, as befitted his role of old and his role to come. She was awake, hunched over a scattering of bones, trapped in games of chance and mischance, the brilliant, confounding offerings of Sir Chul Lath, lord of the hold of chance, the toppler, the conniver, the wastrel of ruin. Too foolish to realize that she was challenging, in the Lord's cast, the very laws of the universe, which were, in truth, far less predictable than any mortal might believe. The errant walked up and with one boot kicked the ineffable pattern aside. Her face stretched into a mask of rage. She reared, hands lifting, and then froze as she fixed her eyes upon the errant.
Kilmandaros.
He saw the flicker of fear in her gaze.
I have come, he said to her, to speak of dragons.